Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Manuel Bonilla on. Manuel is a former teacher and journalist and the current president of the Fresno Teachers Association. Manuel and I dug into the weeds of education, both in the classroom as well as the administration building. If you're looking for a deep dive in education, this is the episode from you. Let's go meet Manuel, and Baker will take us there.
Blessed to infiltrate the pod waves on infinite quests, investigating, making convos to elevate guests. Politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best! Fresno's best!
Manuel, where do you like to eat in Fresno?
There's a few different places. I'd love to eat local for sure. If it's a dinner that I want to take my wife out to, it's going to probably be Max's or our favorite place in the Tower, Vinny Vidi Vici's. But there's some amazing places all over the place in Fresno. There's, if you like Thai food, Sabadi, Dab Tacos in the brewery district. And then one place I think it feels off the beaten path for most people. It is in the heart of downtown, but Libalula. Amazing.
Yeah,
breakfast and lunch. Highly recommend. If you haven't tried that, please make sure that you get out there.
Libalula is great if you've got like vegan or vegetarian friends in your life, because they do so many. Last time I was there, I think I either myself or my wife ordered some kind of vegan option, and it was incredible. And there's not a lot of places that can do that well, that can do vegan and non-vegan options well at the same place. I feel like you can get those respective choices done well at different places, but I have it at the same place. So I love taking people there, and it's in a cool part of downtown as well.
It's a treasure. Yeah, absolutely. And you could tell that the folks that work there, they love their craft and they do a very good job at it for sure. And you're absolutely right. If vegan food tastes this good, then sign me up. So absolutely.
Because it always does. It doesn't always.
That's absolutely right.
So we're going to talk about education. Education has been my career as an adult. Education was important in my household growing up. And I'm curious for you, how was education thought about and discussed in your family life growing up?
Yeah, I'm the son of two folks that they didn't go to college. One of them had to leave high school because of having to work to support the family, right? And there were some family challenges in both of their families, but they knew that education was important. They knew that for their sons, they needed to make sure that they did everything that they could to give them the opportunity. They saw education as a way to advance not only our careers, our economic opportunities, but just to be better people. So I remember this one story. It is way back in the day now, everything's online now, but back in the day in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, you would have folks that would come around door to door and sell you encyclopedias or other types of books like that. And so I remember that somebody came around and there was a student handbook is what they call it. A mixture of some encyclopedia type things, dictionary, those types of items. And my parents bought that for me. And that memory always stuck out for me because they always wanted to be able to provide an opportunity for us to learn more, to do our best, as they always said. And so it was a foundational piece. And as we move forward, and I didn't know what I wanted to do in life, education was a second career for me. I worked in the news business for many years. My wife is a career educator. But I knew that education was important. I wanted to make sure that I gave back to my community in that regard, because I understand the opportunities that it provides to be able to do something. And yeah, it's been a calling, if you will, as a graduate of Fresno Pacific University, both for undergrad and for teacher education. Really love the way in which they framed education. They said education is a calling to redemptive service. And so I see that not only in my education career, but in the role that I am in currently.
Who was your favorite teacher growing up and why? What was it about them that made them your favorite?
I had a number of favorites, if you will. And I think that's the dynamic thing about education and where I think we see some of the turning wrong in the current state and a long way of answering your question is like it feels as if leadership wants all teachers to be a certain way. I had different teachers that were favorites because of different things. And they were always because they were passionate about one particular item, right? There's that you everybody has that quirky teacher that loved maybe nerd books, or this other one that was a strict teacher, but they knew, like this, they were teaching you something about punctuality or whatnot. So I had folks from Miss Goodman in third grade. I had Miss Esther, who was the strict teacher, but we knew that we had to make sure that we did those things. Miss Mikasa in Tulare. For science, just being allowing us to explore science and to teach science in the way that we that inquiry-based teaching, and then even into then my college years, and I feel very connected to one of my college professors, Dr. Bobby Mason, and just talking more about literacy and big ideas and the idea of being provocative, because that's the things that excite not only students but, as we would say, learners. We want to create learners and a love for learning. And so it's all of those folks, right? And I as I look back and reflect, it's because those people showed that they have a love for learning in a specific way that you get to piecemeal and create your own identity based off of those teachers, right?
Yeah, I've got one of my favorite quotations about teaching. It comes from this a spiritual writer a little bit. His name's Parker Palmer. And I love Parker Palmer's book about teaching. And this quotation, I don't remember it exactly, but something like, good teaching cannot be reduced to technique. Good teaching comes from the identity and the integrity of the teacher. And I think what you're saying is exactly the way I feel, which is that good teaching and good teachers are those who know who they are and have the vulnerability to learn with their students and be with them. And I think there's always this kind of push to turn teaching into a science, which I think there are certain things that you can learn from that, no doubt. But I think when we ask teachers to play a role that's not authentic to who they are, that's when you get teachers that are both unhappy and not good in the classroom. And so let's talk about teaching now. I've got a number of questions about it. For you, in an ideal world, how much paid prep time each week should a teacher get?
Think about this. A great question. So when I was in news, right, I went in and I produced a morning show, a local morning show, and we would go in at 1 o'clock in the morning, and that show went on air at 6 o'clock, right? So I had 5 hours to produce a 1 hour show. And in teaching, think about it's the opposite. I have 1 hour to be able to do 5 hours as a secondary teacher of teaching. And just think about that for a second, how backwards that really is. If we want to go deep into it, I don't know if there's a specific number, but I know that it's more than what we have now. And I would say that you should have more planning time than you do instructional time. You look at that in regards to a college-based model. If you see any of your higher institutions, that's typically the thing. And so I challenge folks to like just think about that for a second. And I use my own experience in news to show there is a disparity there, right? It is in that thinking, it is in that planning that those new ideas come and we then be able to implement them.
Should it be graduated regressively, meaning like the further you are in your career, the less time you need? Anyone that gets better at their profession can accomplish tasks, preparation tasks in shorter amounts of time, do you think? Or do you think it should be expanded for everyone?
It's a little bit hard this as an educator. It's in some areas of education we do have these broad strokes, right? I think that the reason why it should be expanded for everybody is because there is some thinking time for a new teacher that they're going to be having to think more about those techniques and about the lesson planning, all those things. But they're coming in with some amazing ideas and a different energy. Whereas maybe your more veteran teacher, yeah, they have those techniques they've seen, they understand the lesson, they understand how it's going to go. But maybe they need some more time and space with their newer colleague in order to explore new ideas. And are there different ways to explore the content? And so that's why I see that as across the board, but for different reasons.
Yeah. Do you think the average teacher likes being observed?
Absolutely not. But that's only because of the structure in which that it is, right? As an educator leader, I can only speak specifically to our district in Fresno Unified. However, I have seen this pattern in other school districts where the process of being observed, or what we'll just call the evaluation process, we asked our teachers, does that make you a better teacher? And resoundingly, absolutely not. Again, that is a systems issue, though. If we could address that, can you imagine what our system would be if people authentically felt like I'm trying this system, or excuse me, this process allows me to become a better educator? But as a system, we're not in a space where we're designing what that looks like. And so what it comes across as only punitive, tell me everything I did wrong and nothing about how I could double down, triple down on my strengths, right? And so it's really a deficit model. And quite frankly, for being in an educational institution, we don't follow the way in which people learn and grow, right? It's just pointing out the negatives as opposed to let's double down on our strengths. And
We would
so,
never do that with students, right? I mean,
yeah, and
if you're a good teacher, you would never do that with
that's
students.
exactly right. You wouldn't do that, and yet it perpetuates throughout the system. And so that's the unfortunate thing, is that then it gets spun into a narrative of you don't want to be evaluated, but that's not the case. I want to grow in my craft. I know that most educators want to grow in their craft. They want to become a better educator, a better person, better somebody that could relate better and to just do better. But that's not the system that we have designed right now. And so part of my charge is to be able to help design something different.
Would you rather teach a class of 10 students or 30 students?
10 students, that's for sure. But I say that obviously as a blanket statement, but the reason why is because that allows for more connectivity, right? We talked earlier about just the idea of education, and that's really, it's a human endeavor, getting to know who they are and being able to figure out from an expert educator side of how do I make this content relatable to them? How do I engage them? How do I create an environment where there's going to be inquiry when there are less students in the classroom? It gives me more opportunity to do that, and then that means that it gives them a better opportunity to learn at a deeper level. So I would default to a smaller class size for sure. And I think that there are areas where you could have a larger class size for other reasons, but in the more general sense, a smaller class size allows me to, and all teachers, to get into that deeper learning.
For you, what are the attributes of effective professional development for teachers? A lot of us get pulled into meetings where we learn like a concept over like 20 minutes, and then we are asked to think about ways we can apply it, and then maybe it doesn't come up again for another 6 months or something as one-offs. But then sometimes you have programs where they want to teach you some kind of new technique or some way to enhance your classroom efficacy. But then it becomes another layer, another task that's added to your plate beyond just everything else you have to do. So for you, what is the most effective form of PD for teachers these days?
It has to be real to the classroom. If you do something, you come in, and this happens quite often in education, as you folks come in as the expert without necessarily knowing the audience that they're talking to, whether that be educators or the secondary audience, the students that are going to be impacted by whatever learning that they are presenting. And then to come in, and I think that we see this time and again in education where it's this silver bullet mentality. If you just do this, then X is going to happen. You mentioned earlier about turning it into a science, if this, then that. And that's just not the way it works. It's just not how education works. That's just, again, education is a human endeavor. So if the best PD has been to just be authentic about, here's where we are in this situation, whether it be something about learning on a social emotional level or on a more academic level, realizing the situation and providing an opportunity, an invitation to the audience, in this case, educators, not to come in and say, you have to do it this way because you're doing it this other way, it's not good. So assigning good or bad, but an invitation to say, if you are facing these situations, here's how you might approach it. What are your thoughts in regards to that? Let's work together to figure out how we might adapt these ideas for your classroom. So that way, the educator could leave that space having learned some of the ideas and with an ability to adapt those things immediately to their classroom. And we don't see that education, we are that PD. Typically, we see a top-down PD model that says, you need to do this. And if you're not doing this, you're doing it wrong. And you need to do, and then a check off of, you didn't put the standard on the board, right? And okay, because if I didn't put the standard anywhere in my life, I would never learn anything, right? That's just not authentic. And so how do we get to that authenticity piece so that way I'm able to get and apply it in my classroom as fast as possible?
One of the hottest topics right now, and this is front of mind in my own school district, is cell phones. And I've heard a lot of different perspectives. I think I have some thoughts, but I'm curious yours. Do you view phones as an asset or a liability in the classroom?
With anything, it's a double-edged sword. I do think that it's an asset until it is a liability, if you will. And I think that, again, just going back to the authenticity piece of what we're dealing with and just being real is that, yeah, you know what? They can become a liability. So then, how do we address it in a way that is human? I think that we as educators have a responsibility of saying, here's how we might be able to utilize it in this particular way. But anybody that's been an educator or even a parent, we know that our kids are going to probably try to test those limits, right? And so when those limits are tested, how are we going to react? And from the teacher's perspective, are we going to have the support necessary to hold a line in regards to whatever it is that school site or school district has created in regards to the rules? I think that oftentimes we don't get to have a conversation about the impact of cell phones because we then get stuck on the enforcement of a cell phone policy. So let's get what are we deciding as a community do we want to do? What do we decide as an education community that we want to do? If it's an asset, great. And then what limits are we going to put on it to make sure it doesn't become a liability? But then once we put those limits need to be supported because otherwise the whole system kind of crumbles.
I couldn't agree more. It takes a lot of vigilance to do it well. And it's just so complicated for so many reasons. We could dig into phones for a while. I want to move past that. For you, what's the most lasting impact of COVID on the teaching profession?
Wow, that's a great question. I think that we saw in those moments that just the amazing grit of our teachers, our classroom teachers, and students. It was in those moments, day in and day out, that the teachers showed up in every way possible and that their students adapted in ways that have never been asked of students to do in the past. It was in those moments where all the fluff of schooling, the bureaucratic nature of school and all the typical stuff, it all fell away. And it was in those moments that teachers, as challenging as it was, to be able to be creative, to figure out and adapt in ways that really get to the heart of what being an educator is and what being a learner is. We know that there's been lasting impact in regards to social emotional needs of our students, the connectivity piece of coming back to our school sites, being able to figure out how do we adapt on the social piece. I see that within some of my own kids, right? So we know that's had an impact there. And I think that, at least in my school district, I think that teachers see that there were going to be times when they were going to be asked to do things that maybe were against their health and whatnot. And so being able to push back and have a voice in regards to those items, along with some other educational items, all these years later, I think there were still some underlying impact there that will carry over.
Yeah, you brought up social emotional learning. That was actually going to be my next topic. Do you think the average teacher's equipped to do that kind of work? I'm married to a clinical psychologist, and I watch the work that she does with people with severe trauma and other things going on in their life. And it's really complicated to help someone in that space. And then imagining my final years in the classroom, I would have a lot of students that had issues, but there was also 40 of them in there. And so it was a challenge. So what do you think the average teacher is equipped to do that kind of work?
Yes and no. And so here's where I think, on the very basis, I think the average teacher does social emotional work. It's just inherently built into education. To be able to lead people through a learning journey is to be able to connect with them on a human level. So, yes, are they able to do that work? Where I think that you're going in regards to that question is on a professional level, when there are some deeper needs, when there's some trauma there that needs the attention of a professional, I think that no, they're not, nor should they be asked to do that. We as a system, an educational system, should design something that allows for the teacher to say, I need some additional support that I am not equipped to do because this requires some additional learning and expertise that I don't have as a classroom teacher. But the system that we currently have, it feels like to many teachers that they are being asked to also be psychologists and social worker. And if for some reason they're not able to do it at an expert level, that somehow they don't care, which is really unfair to the teacher because they absolutely do care. They just don't have the right tools that are necessary to help engage that student and be beneficial across the board, right? So I don't know if that makes sense, but at a human level, all of our teachers care. They want their best for the students, but then there's some that need additional support that maybe that teacher is not equipped to do.
Yeah, I think it's just about knowing when you need to ask for help with a student. But I also, there is also a pressure to like, and it's often cloaked with terms like classroom management, or there's different ways to say it, but it's a lot on a teacher. Now, related to that, I've worked, not my current site, but like I've worked on previous sites where the teacher's lounge becomes a venting location. Which for good reason. Sometimes a day in the life of a teacher is really tough and you need to release. But do you think generally public venting like that in a teacher's lounge is healthy for teachers to maintain a positive attitude around their work environment? Or do you think it's something that you should save for other places and times?
I guess I can't speak to in regards to the teacher lounge. I guess I would ask any parent that is listening. I would imagine you love your kids probably more than anything else in this world, as I do. I have three kids. I love my kids more than anything. And yet there are moments when they are frustrating, and there are moments in which folks need to vent. And I think that is an okay thing to do because you know that you just need to get it out with a trusted person. Now, the when and where, obviously, that makes an impact. I'm not going to vent about my kids in front of my kids and maybe in that communication do some harm in which I am and not intending. I think as human beings, we do need that opportunity to release those, to talk about the issues that are going on. And that's, more of a husband and wife situation or a spouse situation in regards to being able to do that. So I would hope in those moments that people choose the right time and place to do that. I do think it's a healthy thing, and anybody has never complained about anything. I'd love to get your number to find out what Zen you're doing, but again, I think it's again making sure that you're making smart decisions as to when and where that's happening. Because at the end of the day, frustration that you may be feeling or others may be feeling, it's only felt because you want and have an expectation for folks to do well. If you didn't have that expectation, there wouldn't be frustration. That's something I try to tell my kids. If I didn't, and I'm talking about my own kids now. If I didn't have expectation, if I didn't care about you, then I would let you do whatever you wanted, and I would never come to you and feel frustrated. Some of that frustration is because I do have an expectation for you, because I love you. I want to make sure that you don't go through certain things that I could see because you just don't have that life experience. It's definitely a balance, but yeah, obviously making smart choices as to when, where, and how you have those conversations.
Yeah, I think worse than griping or complaining about situations is indifference. Because at least when you're
Absolutely.
complaining, that shows you have skin in the game and you want certain outcomes, where someone that's indifferent just shows up each day, collects their paycheck and goes home, that's way worse. Which do you think is healthier for a teacher, teachers, the profession, to avoid burnout? The traditional summer break schedule or more of a year-round schedule? I know lots of districts have been toying with different ways to stagger break times to make the career for more sustainable. It's primarily centered around student needs, but there's also the teacher element, and teacher burnout is a real thing as well.
I think a good combination of both, and here's what at least my thought process has been, and I wish that we could, as a community, design some pilots around this, right? Is that when you're just talking about time design, we all know that there are seasons within the school year, right? Every teacher knows that beginning to mid-October, that's a rough part of the school year, right? And so, how do we design some natural breaks? I know I've seen a couple of school districts that every quarter they have a week off, right? And so that naturally designs some time to, okay, I have this mental break. I could come back. Everybody comes back refreshed. One item that I think that I would like to explore as a pilot is moving to a 4-day schedule. Right? It expands the school year slightly, depending on how much you give and take in regards to winter breaks and whatnot. But a 4-day schedule, and then that allows for that break in time on whatever day that is a non-instructional day for that additional planning time that we were talking about, that additional thinking time, that grading time, it is a schedule that we actually had during COVID, and I heard a lot of positive things about that. So a combination of those two items, again, that would be great if we're designing together some opportunities there. But one big
How would
caveat.
the 4-day schedule work with the childcare element? I'm thinking about elementary
Yeah,
school.
and I think that's why the design thing is so much of what we do in education, whether it be from a district down to the site level or even district into the community level, it's siloed. Something like that takes some leaders in decision-making seats to reach out to other leaders, right? How can we do this? What is a way in which we can meet the needs? Because there's obviously a need for parent and parents for childcare and whatnot. So are there some programs that we could design, like Fresno Unified does some winter and summer camps? Is there an ability to reach out and to partner with some local businesses on how we might be able to do that? Unfortunately, we get to the statements, the why we can't, before we explore the how might we's. And again, I wish that we could come together and really try to figure out how we might be able to do something different. But again, the caveat is that's one aspect of the schooling design, and maybe that design would help improve some items. But I want to make sure that we don't get into that's the only thing, the silver bullet, right? I know that wasn't your intention, but that sometimes that when we talk about these things, that people put that framework on that, and it's not that, it's how can we design something that might be better, at least in this aspect.
I will say my first job in the teaching world, and I was still working on my credentials, so I taught in a private school in Los Angeles my first year teaching, and it was a 4-day a week school, and on Fridays they did tutoring or like outside activities, and they had like a some kind of PE teacher that would do things, and if you needed help, you'd go inside and get the additional tutoring help, and it was teachers' aides doing some of the tutoring, and so teachers were able to prep, and it was from a teacher's perspective, it was wonderful because you weren't sitting on your couch at 9 p.m. covered in papers. You got a lot of that done on Friday, so you could actually have a little bit of balance. And I think it's a great idea. Let's jump to my favorite section, which is called overrated versus underrated. I'm going to throw a bunch of things at you. You can tell me whether you think they're over or underrated and why. All right. So the first one, PLCs, over or underrated for you?
As implemented in this district, it's overrated.
Okay.
Absolutely. If you were to
Okay.
ask people,
Why?
it's because, again, it's only done as a checkoff type of thing. In theory, it's great. When you send people to the actual PD, the conferences, they say, that's amazing. And then they come back and say, but that's not what's happening. And so it's, at least in my district, I don't know if it's another district, I call it a bastardization process. They say, we're going to do this PLC, but we're going to do it the way in which we do it and not the way in which it was designed to do. Because at its core, a PLC should just be an exchange of ideas amongst a group of folks that are doing similar work, whether it be secondary or whatever. And teachers should be driving that and all that. What it turns into is a very top-down, mandated approach to essentially looking at data. Not that data is bad, right? But where's the discussion about curriculum? Where's the discussion about learning, inquiry, all those things? And that's just the implementation is just not there.
Next one, and this happens a lot, and I'm sure you've experienced it. Bringing in motivational speakers to rally teachers. Is that over or underrated?
Absolutely overrated. Absolutely
Okay,
overrated.
why don't we just need Tony Robbins to tell us how to teach better?
Let's get back to the thing. We're all in the thick of it in regards to I need to meet the needs of my kids. I'd rather have the time so that way I could grade, I could plan. I don't need somebody to come and motivate me. The way you can motivate me is to give me that time, to give me the resources that I need, and to acknowledge, hey, you know what? I see the good work that you're doing. I appreciate it. Let's keep that going. And quite frankly, if I needed somebody to motivate me, I want to hear from my colleagues and not from some outside person, right?
Okay. Next one. Signing bonuses for teachers.
So new teachers, like new
Yeah,
teachers come
so
into a
that's a
district.
recruitment tool, right?
Yeah, I think that I would say that they're underrated with a slight caveat, right? I think that's an opportunity, a design that allows for a new teacher. And again, when they're in a new teacher situation, they probably have some student loans that they probably want to pay off. Maybe they need a down payment on a new apartment or even a new house. I think that it is a one tool in the toolbox in HR to bring folks in. The other side of that is making sure that your veteran folks are compensated at a level where they don't feel like they are being, it's something's being taken away for the work that they're doing as well.
Okay, next one. Me and Ed's pizza.
Oh, I think that it is underrated. I
You're a
think that
fan.
it is, yeah, it is delicious. There's two staples of pizza in the valley for me and Ed's, and I was a proud former employee. In fact, I think pizza delivery is probably one of the most fun jobs ever. I don't know if you've ever been mad at somebody bringing pizza to your house. I've
No.
never encountered that. I love driving around Tulare, listening to music, delivering pizzas at a younger age. And then the second pizza staple is Round Table. So it's a tie between those two.
Next one, National Board Certification for Teachers.
I think that is underrated. I think that allows for an opportunity for and for all teachers to show, I am willing to step up. I am willing to show that I'm going to continually develop in my craft. And so I do think that's underrated. And I think that there are ways in which we could incentivize and encourage educators to do this because this. That process, from everything that I've heard, I am not nationally board certified, but I have many colleagues that are. It is an authentic and rigorous process to show your learning and the development in your craft as an educator.
Okay, next one's an either or. The Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit?
Okay, so it's absolutely Lord of the Rings, and anybody that knows me knows I am a huge Lord of the Rings fan. What's one of the things that brought my wife and I together? She loved Lord of the Rings. I didn't know what that was in college, so I asked her if she could let me borrow the books, and I read them all, so that way I had something to talk to her about, and it worked. And so our first daughter is named Eowyn because of that connection.
It's interesting because I hear more commonly people prefer The Hobbit. It's a little bit more succinct. Lord of the Rings is longer. It's more of a saga, but you prefer the longer series as opposed to the kind of simpler Hobbit narrative.
So everybody is not perfect. So those people that love The Hobbit, I love you, but The Rings is, yeah, they're just wrong. Although I will say it depends if you're reading the book or the movies. In The Hobbit, the movie is the only time I have been absolutely terrified by a CGI character. Benedict Cumberbatch, he did an amazing job with the voice of Smaug. So I will give credit where credit is due. But the depth of the story in Lord of the Rings, both in the movies and in the books, absolutely amazing.
Yeah. All right. Two more in overrated versus underrated. The next one, and I've had a lot of experiences with this, annuity.
It is completely overrated. In fact,
Okay. Can you explain it for people? Because
yeah,
it's
for
kind of a
those who may
weird
not
niche
know,
education topic, but
absolutely.
it drives a lot of us crazy.
Edgenuity is a computer-based program, educational program that allows for students to essentially take tests at their own. It's a competency-based, supposedly competency-based program that allows students to earn credit. Typically, that is supposed to happen because they're doing some type of credit recovery. The reason why I say it's overrated is because it's about the design. So we know that there are some of our school sites, the alternative school site settings in our district, where students may need access to that program in order to continue their education because of life circumstances. But the way in which it is being implemented is that students are allowed to blow off classes, their traditional classes, take an Edgenuity class in the winter or the summertime, and literally pass a semester class in a week because they're able to get answers online, because they're able to do a number of items in regards to this. In fact, a survey, or excuse me, a study came out and said about 50% of Fresno Unified students had to use Edgenuity in order to graduate. That is appalling to education. It is absolutely a detriment to education at the mass levels. Again, we know that there are some alternative settings that definitely need to have access to that, but the way in which our district has implemented it, it's been a detriment to our students and to our classrooms and to learning.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with kind of self-paced curriculum. You know,
Right.
it makes sense in certain contexts. It's just really how it's used. And if it's a tool to, I don't know, pump up graduation rates or whatever it might be, then it becomes a pretty dark situation where, yeah, you have kids just pushing fast forward, or they know that it's there waiting for them, so they can just say, "Ah, I'll just mail it in for a couple of weeks, get dropped out of this class, and then I'll know that I'll be able to take the course over the summer." So, one more topic in overrated versus underrated, Edutopia, the education website.
From my experience, I don't know, but from my experience, it's been underrated. I know that I've visited that site multiple times in my teacher ed journey, if you will, and it seems like they've always had some really thoughtful articles and whatnot. But if things have changed, then it definitely has been not on my radar.
Let's jump into bargaining, negotiations, organizing teachers. This is a big subject. It's one of our favorites, I'm sure. What's the biggest challenge in trying to get teachers organized?
I guess because we have such a big district. We have about 4,500 members throughout the district, 106 different school sites, and getting to every school site, which we did over the last couple of years. We visited every school site in about 6 months, but that's hard, right? And then one of the other things that takes place is that having to push past false divides. Because a system that where many people feel unsupported, folks will create these false divides. Because give it a basic example is that, let's say, a general ed teacher and a special education teacher. The special education teacher may be under demands because of high caseloads and other items, and they're not getting the support that's necessary, but they need to finish IEPs in a short amount of time. And same thing for a general education teacher. They're under some high demands in regards to that. They don't have time to work with the special education teacher. And so that creates this divide as if, oh, you don't care, I don't care. And that's really not the divide when the divide is, or excuse me, the issue is that they're ultimately not getting support from the folks that should be providing that support from the
Yeah, it's
central
a
office and
system
whatnot. And
problem.
so it's a system problem, but it creates this divide that shouldn't be happening that multiple times in multiple areas throughout the system. And then you see that also with a community, right? Because for a parent, their primary contact is going to be their child's teacher. And same situation, special education. You may not know that your SPED teacher or the service provider has four different school sites and a workload that is beyond possible to do. But what you know is that they're not here. Why are they not providing that support? You don't see their advocacy behind the scenes. Working past some of those false divides, one. And two, quite frankly, is making the abstract visible. What does quality leadership look like? When you don't have it and you have to call it out, people understand money. People understand buildings. It's very tangible. They could see that. Showing systems or lack thereof, that's a little bit harder to do. You experience that, but for somebody that might not be experiencing that, how do you show that? And so that's a messaging item.
Okay. I know that there's different kinds of problems where union leadership is needed that emerge at all different sites. For you, looking at elementary, middle, and high school, where do you see most issues arise, or what's the majority environment where union leadership is needed to step in at between elementary, middle, and high school? Where do you see the most issues that you have to get involved in? What level?
So the issues that we and we're different. If you don't mind, I'll take a quick thing just to say who we are as an organization. So Fresno Teachers Association, we believe in this idea of comprehensive unionism, which is I ask anybody to Google that. It's really awesome. So we believe in these three overlapping ideas. One is the industrial model. That's typically what people think of when they think of unions, right? It's salary, benefits, working conditions. But we're saying we're beyond that. We're also these two other things, professionalism, meaning that we want to be the standard bearers of our craft. We want to be able to say we're pushing ourselves to be the best teachers, trade professionals, social workers, and everybody else that we represent. And then finally, a social justice overlap. And I know that term has been thrown around, and now it feels like everybody has their own definitions. The way that we say it is that our students come to our school sites and to our classrooms with different experiences, different needs. How do we meet their needs within the context of our school structure, so that way when they come to our class, they're ready to learn. So we take that chart, all three of those items. And so when you ask, what is it that we usually do? We usually are coming into a space and having to talk about poor leadership and not being supported, right? That's generally the conversation at a site level, whether it be elementary, whether it be middle school. And then the extension of that to district leadership is, Why are we not designing and working together to design ways in which that support is happening at our school sites, right? It's not going to be perfect. We're not asking for it to be perfect, but we are asking to be included and to be partners in that. So that way, our teachers are not at the school sites feeling alone and everything is on their back to fix.
Gotcha. You ask any long-term educator to close their eyes and think of some teacher that they wish was not in the profession. We all have an image in our head. I think they're more rare than the general public knows. But there are certainly people where I'm just like, good God, I wish you'd choose a different profession. What do we do with the truly incorrigible teachers? The teachers because I think a lot of times you're right, there's a lot of teachers who the reason they're acting the way they are is the working conditions, right? But there are some people that just are in the wrong profession. What is there any role that the union should play in either supporting those teachers to think about going somewhere else, or do you think that's beyond a union's capacity to do?
No, I don't necessarily think that. I guess I'll start with this, is that why is it that the framing always seems to be to start with this idea of a bad teacher? And it doesn't start with the idea of, well, is it a bad superintendent? Is it a bad board? Is it a bad area soup? Is it a bad? It's unfortunate that it seems to be that when there's a negative, it starts with maybe it's just a bad teacher. Could you imagine if I said that about a student? If Well, they didn't learn because it's a bad student. Or let's take a look at maybe it's just, they're bad. So that worries me. That seems to be a frame that a lot of people try to start with. And that typically comes to us, well, you guys are protecting bad teachers. But to answer your question, it is not our responsibility to hire or fire. We set up the parameters in which we have due process, right? And we encourage, hey, if you feel like site leader, district leader, you feel like this is happening, then go through the due process. Make sure that teacher is getting all the support that's necessary. And if you feel like you've done all of that, then yeah, you know what? We have a process into which we go to. So we protect the due process and we will question the amount of support because oftentimes when you get into there and you really dig down, it feels like if there are extreme cases where there's a teacher that definitely needs to be removed, then all we ask is that the district follow that due process and make sure that they are being fair across the board as they would with an administrator or anybody else, right? Because if somebody doesn't belong in the classroom, they don't belong in the classroom. Simple as that. We don't want to harm our kids. We want to make sure that we have a due process in that entire process.
For you, what does or what could an effective school board look like?
An effective school board understands that their charge is beyond politics, that their charge is really about how we develop a love for learning, and that we have a vision as to what we want to do. In unfortunately, even in our district, they said we narrowed our goals down to two, but then they expand them all back out with all these other initiatives that they want to do. So, what is it that we really are trying to do? And then are we making sure that the systems and the person, because ultimately a person is making a decision or not making a decision about what's being implemented in our school. So what are decisions that are impacting our classrooms? People in these positions are often disconnected from the classroom and they want to protect their fiefdom. They actually want to design the things, listen to the people doing the work. Allow for that to inform your decision, your policy decision. But we all have to be rowing in the same way. And right now, it feels, at least in our district, there's seven silos, seven different people that have their fiefdoms. And that doesn't make for a good system.
Yeah, I asked Bob Nelson that same question, and one of the things that he pointed to was that school boards are often seen as a rung on the ladder of climbing up the world of politics. Do you also see that as a problem with school boards?
Only in that, so I'll give a scenario. If I know that there's somebody that's going to come into the school board and maybe they are ambitious to go to the next level, as long as they are doing at this level the things that are going to positively impact their classroom, I don't mind that. If they're trying to utilize this in a way to simply advance their career without having the empathy about what decisions are being made and how it's going to be impact the classroom. Yeah, obviously there's a problem. Just to use Bob Nelson as an example, does that mean that he shouldn't have become superintendent because at one point he was the te a teacher in the classroom? Yeah, he moved up. But I would imagine that he would say that he did the work as he moved up in that process, right? So, if a politician is going to go to a different area besides the school board, inherently that's not a problem as long as they're also doing the work while they're in the role that they have been elected to do.
This is a, I'm gonna, what for you is the quality of the average site administrator in Fresno Unified right now? Are they getting enough training? Are they
Here's the thing is that
supported?
I know that I'm probably often seen as the bad guy from that side of the aisle. I have no quality. I understand that's the narrative. And I would challenge anybody on that side. What have we ever done and advocated for that has been harmful to the classroom and for our students? Quite frankly, on the technical level, and I'll get to the answer of your question. When we bargain because of Me Too clauses, parity clauses, we technically bargain for the entire school district. So those administrators, they get better salary, they get better health care, and all of the items that come by. Their schools have smaller class sizes. I have not once in my time here had an administrator ever come to the office and say, "Here's that salary raise. I don't want it. No, thank you."
Yeah, they all
I've
take it.
not never once happened. Never had one call and say, "I don't want smaller class. I don't want those resources." Right? I would love it if they did because at least they would put their money where their mouth is in regards to that. The reality is that, like many of our teachers, I think that they are stuck. I think that they are put in a position to try to do the impossible without the support, vision, leadership, and guidance that they need to lead a school site. And so, what happens is that if you have a naturally gifted leader, they understand how to navigate and to deflect the things that are coming down from the district and develop a culture at their school site. If you have somebody that hasn't been developed and the district doesn't do a good job at developing their leaders, so if somebody is not naturally gifted at that, what I've seen as a pattern is that they typically become micromanagers. Do it because I said it. Do it. And so that turns a toxic culture at the school site. So I am empathetic to site leaders. I know they're being asked to do a lot. In fact, we internally believe that they should be the highest paid administrators in this district or any district because they're doing the work at the school site, right? And so I think that they're put in impossible positions. And then again, whatever happens in regards to their own leadership ability, they have to try to navigate. Our position is, though, do right, try to support. And you know that there's a CBA, there's some language that protects some things. And if you're not, then we're going to try to have a conversation. It's never meant to attack anybody. It's how do we design something differently? If they feel different, call me. We could have a conversation, right? We're always open to that. And again, I just ask anybody, what have we done that has negatively impacted our students, our school sites? I think they'd be hard pressed to say that we've ever done anything that has harmed anybody.
When you enter into bargaining and negotiations with a school district, do you come in with kind of a general strategy, or is it something that organically emerges as you both parties feel each other out and determine where you're going to go?
It's a little bit of both. We've taken a non-traditional approach as an organization to bargaining, and I think that it has I think the district doesn't know how to handle that because they see, in my opinion, they see bargaining just as dollars and cents. And we see it as something completely different. And so we do have a strategy, and that our strategy is we want to change public education in Fresno. And the way in which we do that, as an example, is in our last bargaining cycle, we said that people don't trust this school district. Staff members don't trust it. Our parents don't trust that when they come to the board that people are listening. And so we, in bargaining, said, let's live stream all of the bargaining cycles or all the bargaining meetings, right? And they were apprehensive about that. We eventually got them to agree to do three of them. So it's not when you ask, is there a strategy? Well, our strategy is to transform public education, and we're going to do that in the process in which we do things. We're going to do that in the items in which we address. And so you saw in our last bargaining cycle, it wasn't just salary and benefits. It was things that we're going to do for literacy with our students. It was meeting hours for our teachers. It was, can we have direct student investments for laundry, washers, and dryers at our high school so students could come if they don't have access to that to wash their clothes? And so it's this really comprehensive approach to bargaining that I think puts the district on their heels because they just don't understand it. They only see it as dollars and cents. Quite frankly, if this was just about salary and benefits, we could be done in a very short amount of time. But that's not who we are as an organization. That's not who we are as people, the leaders of this organization. We see it as how do we transform public education? That started under the leadership of my predecessor, Tish Rice, and our executive director, Lewis Jamerson. And we engage the community. In fact, many of the things that we put on the bargaining table were developed from community members, from parents. I literally went, we had a meeting with a group of Latina mothers, excuse me, on their driveway. We brought donuts, we listened to them, we had translators. What are some of the needs for our EL students? And we took that and we made them part of our bargaining proposals, right? So it's just a different approach, and we want to make sure that we're just transforming public education in any way that we can.
Okay. Let's imagine that I set up a round of interviews for new teachers, and we did two rounds. One round with yourself and some members of the Teachers Association, and then a second round with a group of site administrators. Do you think the rankings of the candidates would be similar, or do you think the site administrators and association leadership would identify different traits that were desirable for new teachers?
That's a good question. I think that at least at a new teacher, I think that they probably be a little bit more similar than different. I think you're looking for enthusiasm, particularly for a new or a younger teacher. I know from as an educator, I want to look at some new ideas as well. Try to be hopeful on the administrator side that they're looking for folks that are also energetic and wanting to dig in. I think that question for a transfer teacher might be a little bit more interesting in the sense that it feels like sometimes administrators are looking for somebody that's going to be a yes person
Yeah.
in that on that
Which goes
transfer
back to your
side.
control element, right?
Right. Where I don't know if that's necessarily the case at the new teacher level, or I don't know if you could gather that from the new teacher level. And so yeah, I think that's an interesting question. But I think as a new teacher, I think that things are probably a little bit more in line than not. I think that as the years go on, you're probably looking at teachers want somebody that is going to be pretty straightforward, cut through the BS, where I don't know if that's high on the list for administrators, right? I think that they're a little bit more concerned that what disruptions that or what perceived disruptions might be coming out of somebody that has a personality like that.
There's been a lot of discussion on this podcast with various guests about the role and impact of what they a term that's it's not their actual term, but it's a term that's used for off-ramp schools, different kind of schools that magnet schools for certain kinds of arts or things. Do you think in aggregate those have benefited students overall in Fresno Unified, or are those just kind of ways to appease certain kinds of high earning parents that want to pull their kids out of kind of the quote gen pop of a general school environment and put them in some kind of specialized program?
The impact of that is this: is it's around the narratives that are spun about those particular schools. Because I'm a teacher from McLean High School, Brookings Institute in the early 2010, somewhere around those years, said that zip code has the highest concentration of poverty in America. And what happens is that you have a number of students that get siphoned off to like Duncan, which is really close to it, and one of the type of schools that you mentioned because they do some career technical education programs there, or maybe they go to CART, which is a program between Clovis and Fresno Unified, and they do some amazing learning there. And that's not to take away from the learning that they do. I think that's a great model, project-based learning, those types of things. But then the system turns and they say, McLean teachers, why can't you do that thing with your students? Typically, when you think about those settings, is because they typically have smaller class sizes, because their structure is built in a way that if those students have some behavior issues that disrupt the classroom, then they're sent back to the home school. And so really, those schools are nothing more than what your general typical teacher is asking for and support at our general schools, right? And so that's unfortunate, is that why can't we have those models at every school? And then in regards to just on a learning level, you have your students that, again, as they get siphoned off, are maybe your higher performing students, your A and B students. And now what you've done to like a school site like McLean is that you've taken away the peers that are doing those A's and B's. And so those students that maybe are at the B, C, D level of work, they don't have a peer that is helping them along or being a good role model in regards to how to be a scholar. And that has an impact on that particular school culture as well. Are they a good avenue and do I understand why they exist for parents? Absolutely, I understand. But in the design about how all of our schools should be impacted, all of our schools should be afforded those same structures so that way they could thrive as well. And I do think if those structures were in place, that all of our schools could thrive in those particular ways.
This is a fun question. Do you think there's anything that Fresno Unified can learn from Clovis Unified? And the reason I'm asking this is oftentimes you'll hear, oh, why can't we be more like Clovis? I hear that all the time. I've heard teachers say it, I've heard administrators say it. Do you think there is actual things, or is it just completely different environments, completely different systems, that it's nothing's actually replicatable, really?
I'll give you a couple of answers there. First of all, I think that Clovis should from learn from Fresno Unified and
There
to
you go. Yeah,
give
convert
ACE
it.
is the answer. Our teachers should organize there for sure.
Yeah.
But a couple of items. So I'm tired of that narrative. One of the things that drives me, honestly, I'm tired of the narrative that somehow Clovis Unified is better than Fresno Unified. I am absolutely tired because we have some amazingly talented educators. We have some amazingly talented administration. Our system is not designed well, so we do have some things to work on. But if we could design that, we could be as amazing as Clovis says that they are, right? And so we just serve two separate populations that come to us with some unique circumstances, right? And so how do we serve those students and those populations? To answer your question, though, if teachers from Clovis Unified and administrators would come to Fresno Unified and we flip-flopped and Fresno Unified went to Clovis Unified, I don't think that changes, everything. Like it's not the way. It's about how do we design systems of support. What could Fresno Unified learn from Clovis Unified? Accountability is not bad. It's not a four-letter word. Discipline is not a four-letter word. We can provide the structures necessary in order to provide the guidance that is necessary for the students and the adults. I should be, as an education leader, I should be held accountable to the charge that I've been asked to do. The superintendent should be held accountable. We should want that accountability in our adults. I call it shared responsibility. Don't hold me accountable unless I have an opportunity to have some agency and autonomy in the design of my work, right? That's what I think our teachers want. On the student level, I think Fresno Unified hides behind state law, hides behind a number of items to say we can't do that in regards to discipline and accountability. Again, I ask anybody that's a parent out there, do your kids need some guidance every once in a while? Do they need some guardrails, if you will? And the answer is probably yes. How do we do that in a way that shows kids that when we're in these settings, this is the scholarly behavior that we're looking for? So, yeah, I think that we could learn a couple of items there, and I think that they could learn a couple of items from us.
Okay, I've got two final questions for you, and I've saved one of the harder ones for last and complicated ones. There's a discourse out there that says educational equity problems are just poverty problems, and that if we fix the poverty problem, then education just comes along with it. What do you think of that discourse?
Yeah, I think it gets back into that silver bullet mentality. If we do this one thing, then that. I don't think that we could completely disregard the negative impacts of poverty. I give myself as an example. I didn't know that I was poor. My family, we grew up below the federal poverty line. I never knew that. I didn't feel poor. I didn't think I was what you would think of as stereotypically poor, right? So it's not making this equivalency that because somebody lives in poverty that they can't learn, won't learn, or that we use it as an excuse. Absolutely not. What we do know, though, is that there is strong correlation between those that are in poverty and then their educational attainment, right? And so then, knowing that, how do we build systems to make sure that we are lifting them and giving them the opportunities? So it's essentially coming down to we don't use that as an excuse. We acknowledge that there a correlation exists. How do we design systems to overcome that. And I think that's the part where we don't get past that initial statement and people want to find an excuse as opposed to really digging in and saying, okay, great. If that exists, how do we design a model that really meets the needs of our students in a way that gives them the opportunity? And that goes back to what we were talking about earlier, that social justice thing. Our students may have a different set of circumstances coming to our door, through our gates and into our classrooms than maybe Clovis Unified. We can't change that. But what we can do is, as leaders in this organization, in this district, are we reaching out to the city council? Are we reaching out to county? Are we reaching out to the state? Are we doing everything possible to create an integrated education model as opposed to saying it exists, but yeah, we really can't do anything about it. And that's the frustrating part is I know we can. How do we develop that and how do we do it across the system? Because it is a regional approach. It is different than what education traditionally is.
Okay. We close each of these podcasts with book recommendations. What are a few books you'd like to recommend to listeners?
Okay, so I have my list ready. I'm more of a nonfiction person, but as you heard earlier, if you're going on the fiction side, is definitely Lord of the Rings. Great, deep, amazing. But if you are on the nonfiction side, and this is things that I highly recommend to people. One of the first books I'll give to somebody is really more of an essay. You'll read it in an hour or less. It's called On Bullshit. It's an essay by I believe it's a Princeton philosophy professor. Absolutely amazing. He goes into this intellectual study of BS, and it's an amazing book. You may know of Simon Sinek. He has a book called Infinite Game. And I think that unfortunately in education, we think of education as a finite game, but read the book and it's actually more of an infinite game. And what does that mean? And how does that really change the way in which we see and design items around education and business? Deescalate, which is Doug Knowles' book on how to deescalate anybody in 90 seconds or less. It's really a book about listening and tactical empathy, if you will. A more beautiful question, and that is because too many times we come into situations where we say the statement as if it's definitive as opposed to asking the question. And so asking questions to get to design. Yeah, those would be my recommendations. I think that those would help anybody, but definitely an educator.
Fantastic. To close, what's going on at the Fresno Teacher Association these days? So what's are there big things on your agenda item for the remainder of the year? What's going on right now?
Yeah, we are excited for a number of items. Internally, we're obviously always trying to build community. Externally, we are going to be launching a housing initiative in order to help meet the needs of our unhoused students and families, and coupling that with some literacy items and obviously some additional general education items. And then we are trying to do something where we are filling in the gaps where our educators say that the district isn't meeting our needs in a number of areas. So we're going to do some educator-led professional development. And then we are back into the community, learning from them, listening to them as to what their needs and wants, desires are. So that way we could bring them to the table as ways that we could address education in Fresno Unified. So a lot of things, we never stop. We are going and listening and advocating. And so we're excited about the semester ahead.
Manuel, I really appreciate the work you're doing in Fresno and taking the time to talk with me. Yeah, these education is our most important institution. It's what carries our civilization forward, and we need to take care of the teachers that are guiding students every day, just in the same way as we take care of our students. So I appreciate everything you do.
Oh, thank you for the time. I really enjoy this. I could talk about education forever. And yeah, thank you for providing this opportunity. And again, to anybody listening, get involved. Get your voice is important. How do we change education? Because education really, as you mentioned, it's the common thread throughout our entire community. And it's really going to be the changing force for our region. So excited about that work ahead.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating or review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/Fresno's Best. We'll see you next time.